Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 741 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is your New Comics Wednesday episode for February 27th, 2019. So I'm going to talk about a few of the comics I've read that hit stands today. I'm also going to run down a list of some other titles that you might be interested in. But first, I want to tell you this episode of the Comic Source is sponsored by Aftershock Comics, the independent comics and graphic novel publisher sending shockwaves throughout your local comic shop with groundbreaking series like A Walk Through Hell by Garth Ennis and Goran Suzuka, Animosity by Marguerite Bennett and Raphael De La Torre, Lollipop Kids from Adam and Aidan Glass with incredible art by Diego Yapur, new must-reads like Oberon by Ryan Parrott and Miloš Slavkovic, Stronghold from Phil Hester and Ryan Kelly, and you know we recently had Phil on to talk about that series. And there's also the upcoming Dark Red, a tale of vampirism in the heart of America from Tim Seeley and Corin Hal, which we also talked about recently on our most recent Aftershock Monday episode. So be sure to check out all that's shaking at aftershockcomics.com and remember to read dangerously. And, you know, I'm a big believer in Aftershock. Their titles are edgy. They're high quality from a really great name creator. So I really think you should go to aftershockcomics.com to check them out. All right, let's go ahead and dive into the issues I'm going to talk about today. Let's start with Lazarus Arisen. It's written by Greg Rucka with art by Michael Lark and Tyler Boss. Colors are by Santi Arcus. We have letters by Simon Boland. There's also a ton of back matter, including an original short story called Your Last Meal on Earth, which is set in the world of Lazarus. It's written by Lila Sturgis. There's also some role-playing game material. There's a Lazarus role-playing game that's been created. And in this new quarterly format that Lazarus is going to be released in, there's going to be a ton of back matter and there's going to be resources for this role-playing game in each of the issues. So in this issue, the RPG material is by Crystal Frazier, and it's the World of Lazarus Tools of War supplemental. So for those not familiar, Lazarus is a world that Greg Rucka has created where there aren't really any political or geographical boundaries anymore. Everything is divided up by these controlling families. These families that basically became sort of the ruling parties of this world because they controlled the most financial resources. So wealth has come to equal power, as it kind of already does in today's world. And these families have champions that fight for them that are called the family Lazarus, basically. And they are these genetically engineered humans that basically fight the battles on behalf of the families. You can think of them as the family's avatar or the family's gladiator. And so the story and the world that Rucka and Michael Lark have created is incredibly complex. It's incredibly nuanced. It's compelling. It's very political. And they haven't put out a lot of Lazarus material over the last few years, as opposed to when they first launched it. It was coming out on a monthly basis. So both Lark and Rucka are you know, busy creators. They have a lot of other projects going on. And so that's part of the reason they have switched over to this this quarterly format, which in the back matter of this particular issue, Rucka explains a lot of this and talks about how they feel this format is more suited to the story that they're telling. It allows them to put out 44 pages of content four times a year and helps keep them more on a regular schedule. So I like the format. I like that it's a big chunk of story. I would be lying if I said I like that it comes out four times a year. Obviously, I would want a ton of Lazarus content every month or even every 2 weeks, but you know, that's just not realistic, especially with the level of detail that Michael Lark puts into his art. So it's a very photorealistic noir style, which suits this kind of dour and post-apocalyptic almost world that Rucka and Lazarus have created. So I'm not going to get too into the details of the plot, obviously, because we always like to keep the New Comic Book Day episode spoiler-free, but there's a lot here. There's a lot about the Carlyle family, of which Forever Carlyle is the Lazarus. She's kind of the main character, and there's so much here to explore the richness of the relationships between the Carlyle family members, which has really been at the heart of the story that that Rucka is telling. And if anything, if I had to sort of sum up the sort of behind the scenes story within the story, it is those relationships of the Carlyle siblings, the Carlyle, the head of the family who recently stepped down. And it's about family relationships. It's about relationships that are complicated and that have a lot of gray area, right? It's a lot of opinion. It's a lot of emotion and feeling, and there aren't, you know, black and white answers. And when you think in terms of survival and wanting to be sure your family survives, okay, well, what's the price that you pay for that? What's the cost? What are you willing to do for your family? Which is something that we can all relate to. Hopefully we're not wielding swords and cutting people's heads off. Hopefully we're not put in that situation that we have to do that in terms of saving our family. But throughout the Lazarus story, throughout the story of the Carlyle family, we've seen the family evolve. You know, we saw the former head of the family, Malcolm Carlyle, Forever's father, step down. He's no longer head of the family. We see that his daughter Joanna has taken over, and there's all the sort of the turmoil and the turnover that comes with that. Where do the loyalties of the family lie in terms of now having a sibling, someone that's much more an equal, as opposed to this patriarchal figure that was head of the family before? So it's things like that that Rucka is so eloquently creating, and that Lark is illustrating exceptionally well, because there's no way that this story works without the artwork of Lark in terms of the action, the impact that the fight scenes have, the emotion in the faces. Because this is one of those titles where there's not really a lot of in between in terms of like light action, let's call it. Like, it's either talking head scenes, which, you know, there's always a danger that it gets boring because it is a political book, so it does require, you know, a lot of dialogue to get across the dynamics of the relationship and such. Or it's like hardcore action because Forever is in a fight for her survival, or is mounting an assault for the good of her family or something like that. So it's really, in terms of action, sort of feast or famine. But I enjoy it all. You can get just as much enjoyment out of an issue where there's not a lot of action and it's more kind of set up, because it's so intriguing and it's so interesting and the world feels so fleshed out. So Lazarus is one of those titles that when it first hit, I heard a lot of people talking about it. There was a lot of buzz. And for the last few years, and this may have to do with the slower pace of material coming out, I haven't heard a lot of people talking about Lazarus recently. So I think it was optioned for a television show or a movie or something like that. But, you know, what comic isn't these days, right? So it would be an incredible like Netflix or HBO show. I mean, I'd love to see it on the big screen, don't get me wrong, but I think it's better suited for more long-form storytelling. I almost think of it as like Westworld or Game of Thrones, maybe, you know, not obviously not fantasy, but Game of Thrones in terms of this huge rich world with a lot of different characters and different aspects that you could focus on. So I think it would behoove who's ever optioned it to look at more long form storytelling in other media, as opposed to putting it on the big screen. But I'm glad to see that it's back. I'm glad that this Lazarus Arisen's title is going to be, you know, big chunks of story, and four times a year. That, you know, that's not bad. I'll take it for sure. As I said, I wouldn't mind if it came out a little more, maybe six issues a year. If it was bi-monthly, that would be great. But as opposed to being on a schedule where it's monthly, but it's less story, and then they're skipping every third month. I think I kind of prefer this. So it's great to see that it's back. And yeah, definitely check it out if you haven't already. And I also should mention, there's a really good synopsis in the front of the book from Rucka. He gives sort of the elevator pitch of the story. Then he introduces a lot of the main characters. And then we get a couple of previously pages where he explains what's been going on so far. So if you haven't read any Lazarus, you don't want to go back and pick up any of it in trade. You could pick this up, read this intro, and just hit the ground running. And then you'd have a good idea if it's something that you're interested in that you want to keep reading. And at that point, you can decide, hey, do I want to go back and pick up what's come out before, or do I just want to keep reading from this issue forward? So again, I do recommend it. I think it's a really, really great title. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the next issue, which comes out in July. All right, next up we have Hardcore number 3. It's from a concept created by Robert Kirkman and Mark Silvestri. We have Andy Diggle handling the script for this issue, Alessandro Vitti handling the art, Adriano Lucas is on colors, and I gotta tell you, man, Adriano is killing it these days. He's always been a name I've known due to his work on Thief of Thieves, but between this title and the amazing work he's doing on Freedom Fighters, which I'll talk about in a little bit, he's an early favorite for Colorist of the Year. I just wanted to throw that out there. The letters are by Thomas Maurer, and there's an incredible cover by Dan Panosian. And I want to talk a little bit about the covers of this title before I dive into the story a little bit. And what I'll say about these Dan Panosian covers is it's one of those situations where if you don't have if you're not specifically heading to the comic store and you have Hardcore on your list as something to pick up, but you're just kind of browsing around, these Panosian covers that have been on these Hardcore issues so far are like movie posters, and they really grab you. And so I could easily see, you know, if I wasn't already a fan of Kirkman, Silvestri, Diggle, you know, all these guys already, that if I was just there browsing in the comic shop, I could easily see myself picking up this comic because the covers are so eye-catching. So again, what they most remind me of is like those classic montage movie posters of like the 70s, you know, especially on like kung fu movies and you know, those 70s blaxploitation features and things like that. So hats off to Dan Panosian, who's an incredible artist in his own right, in addition to the great art inside by Alessandro Vitti. So definitely do yourself a favor and at least check out the cover. Even if you don't pick it up, I challenge you to hunt it down, check out the cover, and tell me that it isn't amazing, because it really, really is. As far as the story goes, it's continuing the story of Drake, who is this this agent of the government, so to speak, who basically takes over the bodies of others who are in positions to have access to people that he needs to assassinate more so than himself. So a potential target, someone close to them, is tagged with this needle-like piece of technology that kind of attaches to their spinal cord. And then Drake is able, he goes inside this capsule, and he basically sort of jacks in, if you will, and takes over the body of the person who's had this technology implanted in them. And then he looks and sounds exactly like this other person. He has taken over their body. And so it allows him to get into places that he wouldn't necessarily be able to get to otherwise. So in the first issue, we saw some forces attack the headquarters where this control capsule was kept. Drake was inside the capsule, and now he's trapped inside there. If he comes out, he'll be killed. And these forces that captured the program, this top secret military program, are trying to cut him out. He's jacked into a body, was supposed to assassinate someone, has now taken that body and is on the run. And, you know, he has a limited amount of time before they either break into the control capsule and kill his real actual body, or he's killed because the body he's stolen is being chased by other people. So there's a lot of different threads and different aspects to the story that are all going on at once, which makes for a really fast-paced story. And, you know, I mentioned the covers looking like a movie poster from Dan Panosian, and it's really appropriate because so far this hardcore title has felt like nothing so much as this big-budget, great summer blockbuster action epic, you know, like Air Force One mixed with like Speed and Free Jack and cranked up to 11, if you guys are familiar with all those movies. And so in this particular issue, again, don't want to spoil, but there's something that happens at the end where it's like a holy bleep moment. You're like, wow. It really just hit the fan. And where we go from here, I don't know how Andy Diggle and VT and Adriana Lucas and company, I don't know how they top this issue, because like it just got real big time. And I'm absolutely loving this title. As I said, very fast paced, which makes it one of those titles that you can read quickly because it's a real page turner. So again, it's another one of those titles I haven't heard a lot of critical buzz, but it's certainly worth picking up. Again, the art by VT is dynamic, and it suits this really fast-paced kind of big-budget blockbuster epic that Diggle is writing. The dialogue is quickly paced as well. It's not overly wordy, and again, it's been a really, really fun ride. And you know, I'm finding myself more and more realizing just what an incredible writer Andy Diggle is. You know, I've read a lot of stuff he's done in the past. He did quite a bit of work on Thief of Thieves, which I really enjoyed. He did the recent Shadow Man series at Valiant, which came to an end, which was absolutely incredible. And now he's killing it on Hardcore. So his star is really on the rise. I feel like he's really hit his stride as a creator. And I'm going to have to start paying attention to everything the guy does. So I definitely recommend you guys get out there and pick up Hardcore. As I said, this is only the third issue, so it's really easy to pick up all the issues that are out so far and get caught up. All right, next up we have Rose, number 17. This is from writer Meredith Finch. We have art by Ig Guara, letters by Cardinal Ray, colors by Triona Farrell. And this is the final issue. This is the final issue of Rose, and it's been a great ride. I will say that at the very end of the book, it does say volume 3 coming soon, but there's a foreword by Meredith Finch, which makes it seem like maybe this is it, because it does, her first sentence is, it hardly seems possible that this is the final issue of Rose. So I'm not sure if we're going to get a volume 3 or not. I will say that this final issue does wrap up all the threads and all the storylines, and there's nothing left hanging. There's nothing left dangling. So if this is the final issue of this property, or at least the final issue for now, it feels satisfying. There's nothing where you're like, well, I will really wish I knew what happened with this or with that. That being said, it's a great world and a rich world that Meredith Finch has created. So if she were to come back to it, I would be interested in reading more stories, and especially if she were to do a prequel, so we could kind of see what the world of Tetriv was like before Drusilla kind of, had this darkness, facilitated this darkness falling over the land, or if it was maybe a story of Rose's daughter, you know, if we took a big jump forward in time. So we could sort of see the consequences of what happens in the future based on what happens in this final issue with Drusilla and Rose and the rest of her comrades. So that would be interesting as well. Regardless, if Meredith Finch goes back to this world, I will 100% be in, because it's been a really great ride. The artwork by Ig Guara has been pitch perfect in terms of tone and mood. I've said it before when I've talked about this title, this is one of those books that I feel like is absolutely perfect to get kids interested in reading comics. Like 10, 11, 12 years old, boy or girl, this is the sort of fantasy where there's a little bit of action, you know, there's a little bit of like blood and guts, let's say. Not you know, it's very light, you know, it's not cartoon action in terms of if somebody's fighting with a sword and they cut somebody else, you're going to see a little bit of blood, but it's not gory, it's not gratuitous in any way. It's just a little more realistic, a little more mature than like a kid's book. So that's why I would say it's, you know, kind of young adult, maybe for someone as young as 10. And it's a great story. There's no like foul language or anything like that. So it makes a great bedtime story for kids that are sort of in that age bracket, let's say. As far as adult readers, I really enjoyed it. I like fantasy a lot. So if you're a big fan of fantasy, I think there's going to be a lot here that you're going to enjoy. I think the characters are compelling, and the story is, you know, it's not really deep in terms of Meredith exploring these ideas that are like groundbreaking and thought provoking. It's not that type of comic at all. It's entertainment, and it's fun, and it's compelling, and it's interesting. And the artwork is really spectacular at times. Iguara is an artist that I'm familiar with his work, but I don't know that I've ever seen as much of his work as I've, you know, seen with him doing all 17 issues rather of this title. And so it's been really, really great. The other thing about the title, Triona Farrell, I mean, she's just an up and coming colorist who's quickly rising through the ranks of colorists and becoming a colorist whose work I recognize, both in terms of sort of her style, but also in terms of recognizing it as really, really great color work. So I think the entire creative team did a great job, from the pitch perfect art, like I said, from Iguara, beautiful rendered colors by Triona Farrell, which really helps set the tone and mood, but most of all for Meredith Finch to have crafted a tale that really suits the fantasy genre so well, and interesting characters, a compelling narrative, really well paced. And my hat's off to Meredith. You did a great job on this book, Meredith, and I look forward to more work from you in the future. So again, if we get more Rose, I'll probably be talking about it on the podcast, because again, it's a really fun world and a interesting world that Meredith created. So for now, it seems like it's over, and it was a really satisfying story overall. All right, speaking of endings, the next book I'm going to talk about is Sideways number 13. This is the final issue of this title. It's from Kenneth Rocafort and Dan Didio as storytellers. Rocafort handling the art, Didio kind of handling the plotting. Again, this is one of those New Age of Heroes books, so it's the writer and the artist discussing the plot. The artist goes and draws it, hands it back to the writer. Writer scripts it, and then it's off to colors by Dan Brown, letters by Travis Lanham. So Derek James Sideways is probably the most fun character that's been created by DC in the last year. His powers are interesting. You really get sort of a young Peter Parker vibe with Derek trying to learn what it means to be a hero. So obviously the numbers, sales numbers weren't great on the title, and that's why it's being canceled. And I will say that this final issue feels very much like a final issue, but not really in a good way, if you know what I mean. I think that, again, I don't know, I'm speculating here, but I don't know if Rocafort and Didio really had the space to sort of finish telling the story that they were planning on telling. I feel like they maybe needed another issue or two, because this final issue does wrap everything up, but it feels a little bit rushed, if you know what I mean. It's like, here's two pages that tie up this plot thread. and then here's two pages that tie up this plot thread. Here's two pages that tie up, you know what I mean? And it feels a little disjointed. It just doesn't feel, again, like they had enough real estate or enough time to finish telling the story they wanted to tell. So again, I really enjoy Derek James. I think he's a really fun character. I hope that we see him show up in some other titles really quickly. And but as much as I do, it's like I would probably have to be like a teen book, like Teen Titans or something like that. And then I wonder if there's enough real estate there in a teen book where he has to share the spotlight to really kind of flesh him out as a character. I do feel like Rocafort and Didio did do a great job with the characterization of Derek. He feels very authentic, and I feel like we're starting to get a pretty good idea of who he is as a person. But at the same time, again, you look at a character like Spider-Man, I keep going back to comparing those two, and obviously, you know, this sideways, Derek James is just starting, whereas, you know, Spider-Man's been around for 50 plus years, and it's not really fair. But if you looked at the first 13 issues of Spider-Man, like, so how far along was Peter Parker, his character, developed at that time after 13 issues, right? Like, you had a pretty good idea of who he was, but there was still so much more that was added later that really helped flesh out that character and create this legendary, iconic character that is known the world over. And so, I mean, obviously, it would be crazy to think Sideways would ever achieve that level of notoriety or fame. But again, I'm comparing because it's the obvious comparison to make. And so if, you know, after 13 issues of Spider-Man, if he was just thrown in the Fantastic Four or the Avengers, he wouldn't be the character he was today because he didn't have that solo title to have the spotlight so that a writer could really develop that personality. So it's kind of the same thing with Sideways. Obviously, between a choice of not seeing him show up at all or having him in a team book, I'd rather have him show up in a team book or whatever it might be. But I just really wish this title hadn't gotten canceled because it was a title I really enjoyed. I looked forward to it each and every month when it came out. Kenneth Rocafort is a really underrated artist, in my opinion. He's got tons of detail. His panel layouts are some of the best in the business. His textures, he does an incredible job with that. And the other thing about this comic, the colors have been pretty dynamic. It's a pretty brightly colored color palette from Dan Brown, which really helped the title feel very much like a traditional superhero comic. So I'm glad that this got 13 issues. Some of the New Age of Heroes titles didn't get that many, but I do wish that it had continued even longer. And I know there's a lot of people out there that aren't fans of Dan Didio as a publisher of DC. And it also seems like when he does write something, it inevitably gets canceled. Unfortunately, I'd be curious to know. I'm going to have to ask Dan next time I see him if he even knows, like, what's the longest series he's written has, like, how many issues? Because I know he did OMAC for the new 52 with Keith Giffen. I don't think that one lasted 13 issues, but I'm not 100% sure. So anyway, he did a great job here, in my opinion. It's the best work of Dan's career in terms of writing. And it does end with a question mark, this issue. It says, "The end?" question mark, because we get a little hint right at the end that something that happened in the story may not be as it appears, may not have happened the way it seems to have. So again, it's a great title. I'm going to miss it. And as much as I thought this last issue was a little choppy in terms of plotting and pacing, I'm sure it had everything to do with them wanting to give us answers and to give us satisfying conclusions to the different plot threads that were running around. But another issue or two, I think, would have been great, where they would have gotten to end a little bit on their own terms. But looking forward to Derek James showing up in the pages of something else at some point. All right, up next we have Freedom Fighters number 3. I was mentioning this earlier because we do have Adriano Lucas on colors for this book, but it's written by Robert Venditti, who's a favorite writer of mine. We have pencils by Eddie Barrows, inks by Eber Ferreira, colors by Adriana Lucas, as I mentioned, and letters by And World Design. So the first couple of issues of Freedom Fighters have been really action-packed. The first issue, you know, it started off with a little bit of setup, and then we went right into action. Issue two was all action. It was basically one big fight. And so this issue, it is a bit of a bit slower in terms of action and in terms of pacing. And we get a little bit more insight. And we get a look into sort of the Nazi perspective of Earth-X and what it's been like for the Nazis to be in control of America. That's not to say there's no action, because there's an incredible scene with Black Condor, which is really well-paced and incredibly illustrated by Eddie Barrows. And so that was interesting. But again, the strength of this issue lies in us learning more about the Nazi perspective, how they're reacting to the reappearance of the Freedom Fighters, this new version of the Freedom Fighters showing up, and them wanting to sort of nip this in the bud before Uncle Sam returns. And we're also starting to feel a little bit of the goal of the Freedom Fighters in terms of wanting to return some patriotism to America, because apparently that's the way they can bring Uncle Sam back. You know, we got hints of that in the first issue and the second issue, that if the Freedom Fighters hope to win against the Nazis, they can't do it alone. Not only do they need Uncle Sam, but they need the rest of America to rise up. Uncle Sam can't even return unless Americans start to believe in America again. And once they do that, the possibility exists for Uncle Sam to return in some way. Not exactly sure how that happens. I guess we'll have to keep reading to find out. But even when Uncle Sam returns, again, he's not the end. He's not the goal. He's just a tool to help get there, to help get America back on the path to victory. Because if America starts to believe again, and that allows Uncle Sam to return, then he can be a rallying point. He can be a symbol that helps America and Americans remember who they are. And, you know, a lot of the Americans that are living in this time period that the story takes place were born under Nazi rule. They don't really remember what it was even like. And so it's having to hear stories from their parents or grandparents about what it was like. And so that's an interesting aspect of the story as well that I hope that Robert Venditti gets to explore. So this has been a really, really fun title. I mentioned before that Robert Venditti is an incredible scripter. He always drops little one-liners and little jokes, and there's humor even in a traditional superhero comic like this, where it's you know, pretty bleak in a way. Then the Nazis won World War II; they ruled the Earth, and the little bits of humor that Venditti's able to inject in the story kind of help keep it light and help keep it from getting too kind of dour or depressing. So between that and the incredibly detailed Eddie Barrows art, the amazing colors by Adriana Lucas, like this to me is the best colored superhero comics out there, superhero comic out there on stands right now. He did an incredible job on issue two. Issue three, he's continuing. And what he really does, his color palette is so diverse, because when he's focusing on the Nazis, as I said, in this issue, we get a lot of time with the Nazis. The color palette is very sort of subdued. You know, we get a lot of browns, a lot of blues, a lot of purples. It's very much sort of the darker colors, which helps set that somber tone of the Nazis. But then when it's the Freedom Fighters and when it's the battle, then we get a lot of bright yellows, red, blue, orange, and it's great, the dynamic difference between the two is so obvious. And it doesn't always work when you have a book that has such dichotomous colors. It can feel choppy and inconsistent, but Adriano does an incredible job of making this feel seamless. And so coloring it, you know, I talk about it a lot. It's one of those parts of the process of creating sequential art that I think gets overlooked so many times. And I feel like now more than ever, with the printing technology that's available, with a lot of people reading it digitally, and just the difference in paper quality, we're sort of in a situation where we're getting better color work than we've ever seen before. And that's not to say that some of the colorists from the past weren't super talented as well, but again, they were limited by the tools and the technology of the day. And so, you know, it's hard to look back on a comic from, you know, the Silver Age and rave about the color work because, again, you know, it was newsprint, and they didn't have computer coloring back then. So, they were really limited in what they could do. And so, in a way, it's almost more impressive that they were able to help establish mood and tone so well, you know, back then. And I'm thinking of like old classic House of Mystery and those types of stories, old Western or war comics, where the coloring was, as I said, much more limited in terms of technology, but still helped establish the tone of a story. But now there's no limitations like that. There is computer coloring, there is greater printing technology, better paper, like all that. And so I think that's part of the reason why when I read now, I'm noticing all these incredible colorists who are really starting to come into their own. Triona Farrell, Adriana Lucas here, Marcelo Maiallo is another one. Jordi Belair, obviously, whose work is incredible on anything she does. And so I want to be sure to educate and remind people that, hey, this is a collaborative effort. It's a team effort. And as much as I love line work and pencil work, and I love seeing the black and white images of these stories a lot of times, because you get a different aspect and different tone and feel from the story. When you add color and it's done well, it just really puts it over the top. And so, yeah, Adriana Lucas, absolutely killing it. Freedom Fighters, number 3, great issue, great title. Really have been digging what Robert Venditti and company have been doing. All right, up next we have Detective Comics, number 999. So getting real close to that 1,000. And so I had mentioned previously about wondering if Detective Comics 1000 was going to sort of follow the template of Action Comics 1000, where all the stories and kind of plot threads and such that were leading into that issue all got wrapped up in issue 999. And so issue 1000 stood on its own, right? It's a very different way of doing an anniversary issue. Like, you look at what Marvel does, and I think the most recent like milestone issue that I can think of, it was Amazing Spider-Man 800, and how that wrapped up the Red Goblin storyline from Dan Slott. And it was double size, and they did have some extras in there and such, but the majority of the issue was dedicated to wrapping up that storyline. As opposed to DC, they like to wrap up their storylines ahead of time and just have those anniversary issues as a celebration of the character. So based on the trajectory and the pacing of the story that Peter J. Tomasi had been telling, I wondered, well, it doesn't seem like it can wrap up in one more issue. Maybe we're going to get part of Detective Comics 1000 as the wrap-up of Tomasi's first story, and then the rest of it will be similar to what Action Comics 1000 was. Well, I was wrong. I can freely admit that. The creative team here wrapped up the story that they were telling, the mythology story, in an unexpected way. It's not a completely original idea that Tomasi came up with. And I will say that of his run, which has been incredible so far, this is my least favorite issue. And again, it's not a bad idea or a terrible idea. It's just not a super original idea. And I don't know, I just, based on the dynamic story that was being told so far, I was looking forward to being introduced to a really cool new villain. And we didn't get that necessarily. And so I won't say I was disappointed, but it was just, it wasn't what I expected. And I feel like maybe it's a little bit of a missed opportunity. That being said, it's still a fun issue. There's a lot of action. And the artwork, let me give the creative team. We have Peter J. Tomasi doing the writing, as I mentioned. Pencils are by Doug Monkey. Inks by Christian Alame, Keith Champagne, Mark Irwin, and Jaime Mendoza. So quite a few inkers here. Colors are by David Barron. Letters by Rob Lee. So the art's absolutely spectacular. You know, Doug Monkey is a really great artist. He tends to do a lot of close-up shots, which I think helps with the emotion in the faces. As I don't know that he's the most expressive in his faces, but by using those close-ups and the detail he puts in the work, it really helps to make his art feel very impactful. And I have to specifically mention the color work by David Barron. It's been a really consistent color palette, and I think that's the strength of David's work. He's another one of those great colorists that are currently working, and he's so interesting because he has a very diverse palette when it comes to choosing colors that he uses. But once he settles on a particular palette for a particular title, then he stays pretty consistent, right? And it may be wildly different from one title to another. You know, when he did the Eternity series for Valiant, there were a lot of bright, like blues and yellows and purples and pinks and such. And it was a very brightly colored book, and that was very consistent throughout. But then you look at his work here, it's Batman, right? So you're not going to have those bright colors. So instead, it's a lot of blacks and blues and grays and dark greens and browns. And again, it's super quality. It helps set the tone, set the mood. It feels very much like a Batman comic. It feels like the stories are taking place at night, as they should. And so it really helps to set the tone and the mood. So again, feel like a little bit of a missed opportunity. I think it is a satisfying story. I'm going to have to go back and reread from the beginning and probably in one sitting this whole Tomasi arc. And I also am very curious to read Action Comics 1001. Like, as much as I'm looking forward to 1000, I really want to read 1001 because I want to see, okay, so where does Tomasi go from here? Because the start of this story was incredible. The ending of the story was good. And maybe that's part of the issue that I have with it. It started off so great that the ending is a little bit of a letdown, because while still above average, it didn't live up to kind of my expectations of it. And maybe that's on me for loving the way that it started and it feeling like something really special. And then it didn't quite live up to the billing. So very curious for 1000 to see what's contained in there. I know there's going to be a ton of creators, and it's going to be a big celebration of Batman. Very curious to find out what the sales numbers will look like for DC on that title. But as I said, even more curious to see, okay, what now? What's Action Comics 1001 like? What's that story that Tomasi's planning on telling? All right, up next we have Shazam number 3 from writer Jeff Johns. We have art by Dale Eaglesham, Marco Santucci, and Mayo Senato. It's N-A-I-T-O. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Colors are by Mike Atea. Letters by Rob Lee. So it's the Shazam family in the Funlands, as Jeff Johns continues to tell his Shazam story. And more so than any DC comic that's on stands right now, this feels like a Silver Age book. In the best way. It's fun. It's lighthearted. The art by Dale Eaglesham is absolutely spectacular. Love his panel layouts. Love the insets. Love the way he lays out the story within the panels. Love the detail he puts in the work. Especially love the detail he puts in the work and the facial expressions. And so art-wise, top-notch book and another instance of a colorist doing an incredible job. You know, the Shazam title, the Shazam character, the Captain Marvel character is so, in my mind, synonymous with traditional superhero comics that are fun. He's certainly not the grim gritty. That is not Shazam at all. And the color work here is bright. It's a beautiful, traditional, bright superhero color palette. And the work by Mike Atea, it can't be overstated what an incredible job he's doing, especially with the amount of detail that Dale Eaglesham is putting in the art. We saw at the end of last issue that the Billy Batson, Shazam, and the rest of his Shazam family had traveled to the Funlands, of the magical seven magical kingdoms, or seven magical lands, and you would expect it to be bright in a place called the Funlands and detailed and have, you know, giant candy castles and roller coasters and all that, and you know, rainbow trains and toys and ice cream and yeah. We're not disappointed. Geoff Johns gives us all that and more. Dale Eaglesham illustrates it beautifully with tons of detail, as I said, with an assist by Marco Santucci. And Sen Nato, I believe, handles the... there's a little sequence in here that's the origin of King Kid, where the art is a little manga-esque as he's giving his origin. So I think that's where Naito comes in. And that's illustrated... a little bit differently, different style. It certainly works. And the color palette, while bright, is a little more muted, if you will. Again, to kind of denote that it's a flashback. So I like that sequence. I like that the art was different and the coloring was a little different. It totally worked for me. As far as the story, the scripting, the dialogue, the plot that Geoff Johns is telling, again, it feels very Silver Age. It feels very fun and lighthearted, and I love it, right? This is one of those titles by Johns where you realize just how incredibly talented this guy is at writing comics, and it makes me wish he was writing more comics. Like, come on, Geoff, you can handle one more title. I mean, I know he's doing Doomsday Clock, but that's a bi-monthly. I'd really love to see him do something like similar to his Aquaman run from before. I'd love to see him back on Green Lantern. I imagine maybe he's told the stories he has to tell in Green Lantern. I feel like he never got a chance on Superman to really get into the character, if you know what I mean. Like there was other things going on and Rebirth was being planned and stuff. So wouldn't mind seeing him return to that, or perhaps the Legion. Has he ever done Wonder Woman? Wouldn't mind that as well. I mean, I guess I'm just naming off DC characters at this point. I mean, the guy could do anything, and I'm going to check it out. Or maybe something even creator-owned would be interesting to see. Or maybe a return to the Justice Society. I don't know. Our Man, again, I feel like I'm just, you know, naming off DC characters as they pop into my head. But yeah, I would love to see Geoff Johns do more. But in the meantime, I'm absolutely loving his Shazam run. I almost sound like a broken record here, but again, this is another one of those titles that's great for young readers. It's you can pick up Shazam issue 1. You don't need to know a ton of backstory. Geoff doesn't bring a bunch of baggage or continuity. It's not a high barrier to entry if you're a new reader to jump on Shazam and get caught up and understand what's going on. So the narrative's interesting. What happens in this issue leads into the Shazam family sort of being split up, and I have a feeling over the next couple issues we're going to get to explore a lot more of these seven magical lands that the kids discovered in the Rock of Eternity. All right, now the last book that I'm going to mention for this episode is Flash number 65. It's written by Joshua Williamson. We have pencils by Rafa Sandoval. Inks are by Jordi Tarragona. Colors by Tameyu More. And letters by Steve Wands. I'm going to talk about the colors first. Another great colorist. You know, Tameyu More has been doing incredible color work for a while now, and he's really starting to come into his own and starting to get some recognition, particularly because he's doing the colors on the Heroes in Crisis title that Tom King and Clay Mann are writing. And that title's getting a lot of critical acclaim, and Clay Mann, rightfully so, is starting to get his due as an artist. And Clay is constantly calling out Tomei Umori for making his art look exceptionally great. And so you could say the same thing here about the Rafa Sandoval, Jordi Tarragona art. It's flash, so you would expect it to be, you know, brightly colored, traditional superhero colors. But the story that Joshua Williamson has been telling, this crossover with Batman called The Price, is very much a very serious story, a very emotional story. There's a lot of beats here that have to deal with Wally and what happened in Sanctuary. And there's a lot in this story about what it means to be a hero, the price that you pay, the price that those that you love pay. And so this isn't like an upbeat, happy story at all. And especially considering it's a Flash story, this may be the most, I won't say depressing Barry Allen Flash story, but I'll say the most seriously minded Barry Allen Flash story. And so because of that reason, I feel like Tomei Umori chose a more muted palette, and it completely works for the story. So this ending was perfect. This ending was emotional. There is tension. The story ends and there remains tension between Barry Allen and Bruce Wayne, Flash and Batman, and rightfully so, based on what happens in the story and the sort of the consequences and the fallout of it. I love the ideas that Joshua Williamson is putting forth. He's another one of these writers who's incredibly talented, and he's so interesting to me because, you know, some of his Flash stuff has a lot of connective tissue with Geoff Johns and what Geoff Johns is doing in Doomsday and with DC Rebirth. But then, like, this issue has so much to do with what Tom King and company are doing with Heroes in Crisis. But then Joshua also ties a lot of his stuff into what Scott Snyder is doing over in Justice League. So it's almost like Williamson is kind of at the center, and he's collaborating with everybody in a way. And I love that. It makes this Flash book seem so central to everything that's going on in the DC universe, and I love that. So that being said, the reason I did enjoy this book so much was because of that dynamic relationship between Batman and Flash, and them seeing each other in a new way. You know, these heroes that have known each other for decades, and they're looking at each other in a new way. They're dealing with the pain and the emotion of Wally's death, and there are a couple of scenes here. There's especially one in the Batcave toward the end where it feels emotional. It is impactful. It's really, really great, and it's one of those books that makes you think, that makes you say, wow, maybe, like, who's right? Like, whose side are you on? Is the price too high? What are the consequences if you make these choices? And that's what we're starting to see. It's again, what we were seeing in Heroes in Crisis from Tom King and Clay Mann and Mitch Gerrards and Tomei Umori and that whole creative team. And I'd love to see it spill over a little bit into the Flash title. And again, it makes a lot of sense based on the fact that Wally's apparently been killed in the pages of Heroes in Crisis. And it's great that there's this, you know, Flash-Batman crossover that I think this is the third one that we've seen now between these two books. And they're so different, right? Like, Barry's traditionally this bright optimist. Bruce is obviously much more of a pessimist, maybe he would say a realist. But they're both heroes, and they've both made sacrifices, and they're both doing the best that they can. And now we see them sort of at odds based on what has happened in this crossover. And it looks like there's going to be lasting consequences of this going forward. So again, a really impactful issue. an issue of consequence, and some really incredible dialogue, emotional dialogue for these two heroes. And the fallout is going to be felt for a while, I think. And it's also going to probably tie into Heroes in Crisis a little bit more, because there's a little bit of an epilogue that gives us an idea going forward that there are some mysteries and some plot threads and some stories still to be explored. And the little blurb at the end of the issue specifically mentions that the mystery of what Batman and Superman are talking about here at the end, and also perhaps the person who was behind Gotham Girl's attacks, it's all going to tie into DC's Year of the Villain, which is sort of their tagline for 2019. It certainly looked like Bane. I mentioned that when I talked about Batman number 65. Whether or not that turns out to be the case, I guess we'll see. But this was a really, really incredible issue. And it has to be my book of the week, just based on the incredible job that Joshua Williamson did, and the lasting impact and ramifications of the story. But really, like, when I look at these, I mean, I talked about, what, 2, 4, 6, I talked about 8 books. Any one of them could have been my book of the week. It was really close this time, actually, because they were all so incredible. Sometimes it's close because everything is just sort of average. But I could have picked a Rose or Sideways based on the fact that they were the final issues. And, you know, they were worthy of those particular series. Freedom Fighters has been spectacular. Shazam has been spectacular. Lazarus has returned and is really, really great. So I could have picked that. Hardcore, you know, I went on and on about what an incredibly fun action-packed title that is. So, yeah, every book this week was that I talked about was really, really great. So it was a close call. But ultimately, I'm going to give my book of the week to the Flash title. So let me give a rundown on some of the other titles that you might want to be on the lookout for that are on stands today. From Aftershock, the only thing on stands new this week is The Clan Killers Volume 1 trade paperback from Sean Lewis, which is a really trippy, out there sort of alternate universe horror comic. It's hard to sum up in just a few words. Over at Boom Studios, we have the fourth issue of Firefly. From Dark Horse, we have the second issue of Fight Club number 3, which is the second sequel to the Fight Club story and movie that a lot of people know. From DC, in addition to the books I talked about, we also have Action Comics number 1008, which is part 2 of the Leviathan Rising story. We'll be covering that on an upcoming Superman Sunday pretty soon. We also have Heroes in Crisis number 6, which was an interesting issue. We'll be covering that on an upcoming Spotlight Friday as well. Justice League Odyssey number 6 is out today, as is Martian Manhunter number 3. And I almost talked about that. If I didn't have so many books that I was talking about already, I would have talked about Martian Manhunter as well. That's been a fun and entertaining series. The only issue I have with it is, you know, we've seen some new backstory, some new information about Martian Manhunter in the pages of Justice League. Plus, we've seen, you know, previous iterations and origins of Martian Manhunter. I'm worried he's going down the Hawkman path, where there's going to be all this different stories and issues and titles that talk about his origin and his early years, and it's not all going to fit together, because different writers are using him in different ways, and I think it's going to become convoluted. So I'm curious if that can be cleaned up or explained. We also have the 13th issue of Terrifics, and Wonder Woman is up to issue 65. Meanwhile, over at Image, we have Die, Die, Die number 8 from Robert Kirkman and Chris Burnham. We also have the final issue of Rose, which I mentioned, and Spawn is up to 294, so getting close to 300, which I'm sure will be a really big deal. From Marvel, another number 1, Age of X-Men. This time it is The Extremist. The Avengers No Road Home has its third issue on stands today. The second issue of Chip Zdarsky's Daredevil is on stands today, as is Fantastic Four number 7 from Dan Slott. We also have the second issue of the anthology Marvel Comics Presents on stands today, second issue of Savage Sword of Conan, and the third issue of X-Force from Ed Brisson. Over at Valiant, we've got Bloodshot Rising Spirit number 4, which I gave my thoughts on this last Sunday's Valiant Sunday, and there's also the first issue of The Forgotten Queen from Tinny Howard, which was a really, really great read. So that does it for the issues that I wanted to mention. Don't forget, this episode has been brought to you by Aftershock Comics. Be sure to go over to aftershockcomics.com, where you can find links to creative lineups and series synopses for all their titles. They even have links that will take you over to Comixology, where you can buy the comics digitally. So every series that's ever been released from Aftershock is there. You just go and click on the series menu, and you can find incredible titles like A Walk Through Hell, previous titles that have come out like Jimmy's Bastards, my favorite title of all time from Aftershock, which is a replica from Paul Jenkins. It's all there. It's all edgy. It's all quality. And it's a very diverse lineup. So again, I really encourage you to go to aftershockcomics.com, find a title that you like, jump into Aftershock with 2 feet, read dangerously this year, as is their slogan. We'll continue with Aftershock Mondays. We'll continue to bring you interviews, reviews, and all kinds of great Aftershock comics in the future. So be sure to listen to Aftershock Mondays. Be sure to go to aftershockcomics.com for all the information about the series, the Diamond preview code, so you can pre-order the titles from your retailer. So once again, I want to thank everybody for listening as always. Don't forget to tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All 3 spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.